relay that gets pulled in and latched. And it's being latched by the stored energy that's on the continuously being supplied on the input end by Con Ed or LIPA. Now let's look at the reverse. If Con Ed or LIPA is not there, so the house itself is essentially dark, but I'm now creating power on the output end of the GFI and feeding it backwards. And even if the GFI is properly designed so that even in that unusual circumstance, it can still detect the unbalance in current because of a ground fault. And it begins to trip. Instead of beginning to trip, obviously those relay contacts are a break before make. Otherwise there'd be one hell of a short circuit it makes periodically. So it's a break before make. So it begins to do the tripping process, and it makes the break, and hasn't yet made, it hasn't yet gone to latch. So therefore, it's beginning to open up those relay contacts, but in so doing, the primary side, the input side of the GFI, is no longer powered. It no longer has a source of energy to pour it into that coil to bring it all the way through to latch. Therefore, it can sit there and vibrate and buzz, but never latch, and therefore give you essentially no protection. That is a scenario that I believe could take place on the design of most GFIs, and I think it's something to worry about. You might have a comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2MDT.
Steve recognized, but Glenn first.
No, Dick, I absolutely agree with you 100%. And just one other little tidbit just to add to that is that anytime you're using equipment, power supplies, anything with metal chassis on the outside that's connected up to line power going into 115, 220 outlets, anything, always make sure you really don't want to plug into GFI because you're really not going to have a good solid ground from the from that metal metallic case. And if there are Y capacitors, anything attached between line and neutral to that ground, there's going to be current flowing into that ground. May not be 2 milliamps enough to trip the GFI, but you're going to have an elevated voltage on the metal chassis. Those particular applications, I always prefer the old standard grounded outlet that has a good solid ground on it. And if you're attaching a piece of equipment like this to a wall outlet for the first time, if you have a multimeter or a small test light or something to measure the chassis, you know, the chassis of the device to the local ground around the area, just make sure that there's no voltage buildup on the chassis, because you're always running into that kind of situation where you can get an electrical shock, and your best protection is just having the best possible dirt can ground for that chassis. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yes, stand by a minute, Steve. I haven't forgotten yet. Glenn, I'm on to something else here now. I'd like to believe that a good design, a well-designed GFI, which has three wires going into it, and one of them is the true safety wiring, let's call it grounding wiring, and the other two wires, I'm going to call it the hot and the return. But I'd like to believe that the safety wiring ground that has been established inside of the house is now carried through the GFI to the third prong, the safety green wire ground pin on the output side of the GFI. I want to believe that. And now, when the GFI is sensing any imbalance that it's supposed to trip by, it is doing it by way of a toroid transformer, that one of the toroids or a portion of the toroid transformer is looking at the hot lead flowing through the toroid. Another toroid, or the same one, properly done, is also looking at the return lead with a toroid, and so by remote means, so to speak, without disturbing the normal wiring of hot, return, and ground, it is doing sensing of current very similar to a clamp-on ammeter, and therefore good grounding that would have occurred without the GFI should be still occurring with the GFI. Safety grounding, I'd like to believe, is being carried through the GFI. The way you're wording GFI usage in this application of a metal chassis through a GFI leads me to believe they've done something to interrupt that safety grounding with some kind of a sensing circuit. I hope that that safety grounding through the GFI is still there. Please correct me. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think the first problem when you're talking about ground fault interrupters are the standards on them are very loose. If you look at the tolerances on them and how they're to be constructed, no two ground fault interrupters are the same. If you start taking them apart and look at them, I think you'd be horrified. Some of them have resistors in the ground that detect current. They're horrible. As I said, generally plastic case devices, things that are, you know, that are used to for portable use, ground fault interruption, I think it's the way to go. I think on metal chassis items, industrial circuit items, I wouldn't trust them, Dick. I would always want to make sure that that ground pin was on a good solid return and that all the wall outlets in your house are on good solid return back to the chassis, Dick. Here again, this is an opinion. I've taken quite a few of them apart, but in my case, it's a strong felt opinion on that one. K4IW, KC2, QIQ.
Hey, Glenn, I think you're onto something here. If you have seen commercially manufactured, UL-approved GFIs that have sensing resistors inside, particularly on the safety wiring portion, if you have actually seen that, which you and I, with our supposed electronic knowledge and experience, look at that and are horrified and think it represents a safety issue. But there's a brand out there being sold with that. I don't think we should keep that light under a bushel basket. I think that's worth an investigation. I think it's worth an investigation article, so to speak, in respected magazines, newspapers, somewhere. If safety wiring is being compromised by less than ideal designs of GFIs, I think the public should be made aware of this. That's step number one. Step number two, somebody should create a test procedure by which, by some magic means, you grab onto the electrical potential of Mother Earth, some kind of an ideal ground somewhere, and then by some kind of instrumentation that hopefully is not too expensive, you then probe the safety wiring, the third pin of every single socket of your house and every single safety wiring third pin of the output GFIs of your house, and make sure you measure some very small number of ohms in order to confirm that you really do have safety in your wiring. And if not, know about it and start correcting it before an accident occurs. That's my second point on that. You might have some opinions on all this. Back to you, Glenn, KQLIW.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Dick. I didn't want to hug the net here tonight. But just one quick statement on top of this. You have to look at the UL standard 1915, what it's really set up to meet. And yes, these things do meet the UL standards, and they're all within their specs and tolerances. But there again, when you're using industrial devices, things with metal chassis, you really don't want to be going into a GFI with those leakage currents that are coming off of them. The UL standard kind of tells you that. It's automatically in it, that those are to be hard grounded items. When you look at rack systems, other things like that, no GFI in use. They're supposed to be basically only office equipment and things with plastic cases. You look at your computer, plastic case on the outside with the third ground pin. Those are the devices that are supposed to be plugged into GFI. Things that are used in the kitchen appliances. But the heavier industrial components, things with metal chassis, real no-no on GFI. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Well, I'd like to have a separate ground wire, green wire, to the common ground house system.
Yeah, that green wire is supposed to be the safety wire. I'd like to believe it's got a very small number of ohms from that third prong, the safety prong of every outlet in my house, back to the fuse panel, back to real Mother Earth. I'd like to believe that. But with GFI uses, it's becoming a little bit doubtful in some of what I'm hearing. Let's see what Steve's got to say about all this. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. First thing, as far as water meter grounds, this has been code for, as long as I can remember, 25, 30 years, that the water meter, you have to have a non-broken jumper between the water meter. In other words, the ground that comes off the paddle, it's one side of the pipe, jumps across the water meter with clamps, the other side, and that's unbroken. As far as GFIs, I'd say probably the past 10 years, maybe not 10 years, I'd say 5 to 7 years, all the new GFIs, they're basically what I like to call heat proof. You wire them backwards, in other words, you put line to load and load to line, or if you put the hot and the neutral reverse, the GFI will not reset. There'll be no power coming out of it. As far as the being grounded, as long as you connect green ground wire to that GFI is grounded. I mean, there's zero alarm between that ground screw, which goes to the ground wire, and the ground terminal inside the outlet. That's it.
Yeah, that does not seem to be what Glenn is saying, and maybe Glenn has opened up some more marginal brand names that snuck through the system somehow. And another thing that worries the daylights out of me is that a significant number of new houses are coming with the equivalent of PVC water pipes, non-copper water pipes. And there's advantages and disadvantages as far as the quality of the potable water is concerned. But when it comes to grounding of electrical appliances, a substantial portion of your house has got PVC piping as opposed to really conductive metallic piping. That scares me. You're losing some of the backup grounding system that a good house should have, and now you're dependent on that one single set of green wires going to those safety pins. And I can see a couple of scenarios in which somebody doing some rewiring of a house could create an awful lot of grief. Some of you guys must have some opinions on all this. Give me your call at KQRIW-ZECNET.
KQ2-MDP.
Any more comments?
MDP and Glenn in that order. MDP first.
Yeah, you are correct with the PVC pipes in the house. It's not the ideal situation. Basically, what LIPA wants you to do, what National Board of Fire Underwriters wants you to do is set two separate ground rods, 8 foot long, 5/8, 8 feet apart. It's not the ideal situation because, like you said earlier, a ground rod is not the ideal protection for a ground system next year.
It's better than nothing. Go ahead, Glenn.
I just want to give you a quick scenario here to put this to bed real quick. Let's say you have two pieces of industrial equipment, both plugged into ground bolt interrupted outlets, and both are being supplied by power, but from two different ground bolt interrupted outlets, or let's say one is not plugged into a ground bolt interrupted outlet and the other one is. Do you take a ground bolt interrupted outlet and take a 30 amp power supply and take the ground pin on one side, put 30 amps through it? You'd be surprised. You can open that ground in the ground fold. They're not designed to handle high currents. They open at 2 mils. Yeah, they might have a low impedance with an ohmmeter, but not when you start pumping current through them. You take an outlet, like a good old Leavitt type of old-fashioned 3-pin outlet, put 30 amps through the pin, and that thing will be, you'll see less than a volt when you put it through it. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, we're into an area now which is only partially understood. A significant number of people apparently have died during catheterization procedures in hospitals because of the equipment that was being used was imperfectly grounded. Even though there is safety wiring, which looks like it's properly done, going to the instrumentation that's being used during a catheterization procedure, and if it happens to be a coronary catheterization procedure where a very small amount of current, I think it's in the microamperes, going through a conductive catheter into a critical portion of the heart could send you into fibrillation and get you into quite a bit of trouble. And so where can those couple of microamps or a fraction of a milliamp come from? Well, three rooms away, somebody turns on an industrial vacuum cleaner that is pumping current into the safety wiring and creates a few millivolts of drop across the ohms of that wiring. Or it could even be volts. But a simple act of turning on a vacuum cleaner on a similar circuit, even though it's quite a few rooms away, could create another voltage that could create grief. Now, maybe this problem has been alleviated. Maybe all the instrumentation these days has fiber optic coupling type connections, so the signal flows, and therefore no real signal can flow into the catheter. I'd like to believe that. I'm a little worried. Anybody got any comments on all of this? K2LIW and the TechNet. Okay, the word safety and the word wiring. We ground our circuits for reasons of lightning, but that's secondary. The primary reason we make sure everything is grounded is to make sure that a chassis that you touch with your hand or the SO239 connector you touch with your hand can be above Earth ground. The first example I had of this was when I'm 15, 16 years old, standing on my concrete floor of my basement when it was dry. Got excited one morning, decided to go listen to my ham radio we set up, and it was a Heathkit AR3 receiver. Back in those days, it didn't have a 3-prong plug. It only had a 2-prong plug. And from each side of the 110-volt line, there was something like a 0.02 microfarad just ceramic capacitor to chassis of the Heathkit AR3 receiver. Therefore, it was a capacitor divider network between the hot lead and the return lead that I was plugged into. Therefore, my chassis of my Heathkit AR3 was floating at half voltage, 67 volts. When I touched that chassis and my bare feet were on that concrete floor, I felt damn uncomfortable. That was a safety issue. And so with the 3-prong plugs that we now have, a hell of a lot more safety has taken place as long as everything is properly wired. But even that device that you buy from Radio Shack that you can plug into the wall to confirm whether or not the 3 leads are properly wired, it is a good test. It is not a perfect test. There's one particular combination of improper wiring between hot return and grounding, and hot return and safety, where I can make an error on all 3 just right, and that little device that you use will give you just the right colors of light flashing, and you think everything's all right. And that particular socket in the wall, the so-called safety wire, the green wire, could be hot. And what you plug into it, which doesn't have double insulation, something with a metal chassis like Glenn has been telling us, there's a slim chance you could end up with a metal chassis that's hot. A potential very lethal situation. Yes, we got to be careful. We have the instrumentation to make the measurements. Properly used, a voltohm-milliammeter or a digital voltmeter is capable of measuring potentials from point A to point B. And by choosing the right place to use as a ground reference and measuring everything else in the house, in theory, while things are under load, in theory, you can find some of these faults. Not many people have got the enthusiasm to do that or the knowledge of what they're doing when they do it. So part of what I think Glenn is saying is that when a house is being wired and fed temporarily with a generator and you're getting a false alarming of the ground fault indicators, I was guessing at first,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout.
I was guessing that it would just be the spikes on the generator false alarming the GFI. Glenn is fairly convinced that the house with that new wiring really had a leakage somewhere that was firing the GFI, and that should have been investigated further as opposed to just blaming it on the portable generator. And I am curious that when real Con Ed or Lifer power was connected, that the GFIs continue the trip. And what Glenn is saying is that even if you did get a trip on the GFIs but didn't get a trip on LIPA, it may be telling you something, because the motor generator set was a floating kind of a generator. You're setting it up on a wooden floor on a house that's under construction, and you're running the darn thing. Depending on how you do or don't ground it, you could be getting different results. And there's probably a whole test procedure that should be followed there to make sure the house is properly wired. I know darn well that electricians, under the heat of battle of getting the job done fast enough that they're still running at a profit, and yet pricing it low enough that they win the job in the first place, under that heat of battle situation, are these procedures really being followed, if they exist? Is there a formal test procedure to really confirm the integrity of a newly wired house? There's probably a UL code for that. But is that really being followed? Is it being properly inspected? Is it being truthfully inspected? Let's see if Glenn's got some opinions on this one. KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2MTT.
Steve, recognize also. Glenn first. Maybe Glenn got called away. We'll go back to him in a minute. Steve, go ahead.
Okay, just clear a couple of things up. Let's see, where do I start? First thing with the GFIs, as far as the generator. You know, everything was properly wired, like you said. It probably had something to do with leakage of the generator, you know, leakage of the generator or something with the GFIs. As far as the little Radio Shack test is, yeah, you're right. You can do almost anything. I mean, I can make the green wire, the hot wire. I can make the black wire, the neutral. I can make the white wire, the ground. Completely 100%, 180 degrees warm. As long as I put that thing on the outlet the right way, yes, that little indicator will say, yeah, everything's fine. Meanwhile, the wiring is totally messed up, totally wrong. It's not code. The inspector would see this. You know, basically, the red X on the filing form, sorry, you failed. And like you said, a lot of inspectors, they just walk in. What they'll do is they'll do a rough inspection. They'll go around. They'll basically make sure there's not too many wires in a box. They'll make sure you use the right size wire, you know, 20 amp for kitchen, 15 amp for lighting, you know, 30 amp for an electric dryer, so forth, so on. Then they'll come back, you know, once the job is finished, they'll basically do, you know, the final inspection. And, you know, some of them will actually open up a couple of outlets. You know, they're not going to take the whole place apart, but some of them will actually open a couple of them. Most of them go around with that little Radio Shack tester we call Snake Eyes with the three lights. They check it. They get a correct reading. They go. They check the GFI. So long as the GFI trips, they sign the job off. Yes, everything looks good. Everything seems to work good, and they're out the door. I agree with you. The inspector should do a much better job. Back to you.
Snake Eyes. I can see why it's got that name. Good name for the darn thing. Okay. Steve, to your knowledge, if I had that rare object, a 220 outlet connector, on the outside of my house, because I wanted to run a 220 powered compressor outside the house, my guess is there's a number of ways that that could be done very unsafely. And even if that 220 was a GFI-protected circuit, I think I can see ways that the GFI might be misdetecting. And is there a real 220 outdoor outlet GFI circuit that I can buy? How back to you, Steve.
I'm going to drop. They do make 20 or 240 volt GFI circuit breakers. To my knowledge, they do not make any GFI susceptible to 240 volts. Yes, you can get in trouble with that. I mean, code says it's perfectly legal to run a piece of two wire, you know, be it Romex or BX, which is a black and a white. Most people think the white is neutral. There's no power on it. But in a 220 application, such as, like you said, a compressor or an air conditioner or anything that only requires 240, no neutral, you know, instead of a 240 volt three wire circuit, you can use the white as a hot light. You're supposed to take the black, but like you said, in the heat of battle, a lot of guys don't take the black. So I usually tell my guys, as I said, use the tester, don't trust your tester. Make sure the circuit's dead, make sure the other wire is live. You know, I basically explain to them, a lot of these guys use these little bolt pens, you stick them in the outlet, thing will make the noise or it lights up. How many guys get into trouble with that thing? They go, they stick their thing in there, it makes a noise, they go downstairs, they think they turn the circuit off, they come back up, they start taking the outlet or whatever it is apart, and bam, they get nailed real good. And I say to them, I say, now you just learned something, that never trust anything. Back to you, Dave.
When you use that detector that detects whether or not a circuit is live, the second time, if you think you've tripped the circuit panel, and hopefully you lock out the circuit panel some way so that somebody doesn't come along after you and reestablish that circuit. There's a number of ways you can get into a fault there, but you've locked out the panel, you put a big red tag on it and a message and so on, and then when you go back, you should use that sniffer again to make sure the circuit is really not live. Is that a almost acceptable procedure, Steve? Go ahead.
You should use incandescent lamp, 110 or 220, depending on the voltage.
And let's do both. Let's see your comment on that one, Steve.
It is acceptable, but like I said, I wouldn't trust it. Because a lot of times I found these things, a lot of times that once the batteries start going a little bit dead, they'll be on a dead circuit, they won't be on a live circuit. Some of these things, you can take, stick them on a piece of wood and they start beeping. So I wouldn't trust them. A test lamp or a meter, exactly, is the best thing. Make sure it's dead before you start messing with the mechanism.
Yeah, there was a technician, a wiring, what am I looking for now? Can't think of the right word. A person in the field of doing household wiring for many years' experience was rewiring a fuse panel on my property not too long ago. He was positive the circuit was dead. And boy, did I hear a nice loud noise when he found out otherwise. Lucky the current didn't flow through him. It flowed through a piece of wire and a screwdriver. But educational process. Lots of ways that power wiring can get you in trouble. Okay. There's got to be some good news here tonight. What would you guys like to be discussing? Give me your call letters. K2RW and the TechNet. Okay, Paul, WS2N, are you available? And is there anything we should be knowing about in space? K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, this is WS2N. I don't think, not much. Listening to the news, that hurricane did go through Texas, and that's where NASA headquarters is located when they operate all their missions, and they say, you know, this is Houston, you know, they're talking about just north of Galveston, so they did evacuate the Houston Johnson Space Center, and everybody wonders, well, what's going on with the control of the International Space Station when that's going on? Well, they have a backup. They have an identical backup system for operating manned space flight in Austin, Texas, a couple hundred miles away inland. They did utilize that facility, but now they'll be able to return. So it shouldn't change any future flights, Dick. So I thought I'd mention that. Let me drop it a second. And also the Large Hadron Collider. I mentioned it last week, and I said, hopefully it will come on successfully, and it did. They operated it last week. This thing has been in the building phase probably for 20, 30 years. They've been thinking about this thing in CERN. Switzerland and also France, almost 17-mile circumference of a machine to smash atoms together, hadrons together to study physics. So I think they come online, and if you watch the news, they even had a little piece in the Newsday about it. That's underway. They have four gigantic detectors surrounding this ring, and they'll be looking for things in different dimensions, waiting for gravitons to show up and then maybe disappear. It might go into a different dimension. They'll be looking for dark matter, and when we drop it. They'll be looking for the missing Higgs boson particle, so-called God particle. They'll be looking for all of this stuff in the near future. So we'll hope that goes well. It was, I think, a $6 to $8 billion project. Many, many years to bring online. And that's really extension of what we have here on Long Island at the Brookhaven Lab, the RIC program, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider, that has 2.5 mile to do a similar type of thing. They also have one out in a Fermi lab, which is bigger, and of course this thing is like the granddaddy of them all. They had originally planned on years ago building the SCC Super Colliding Conductor in Texas, and that was going to be like a 50-mile ring, but that was canceled by Bush number one when he was in office. But that was under construction. They had $1 billion worth invested into this, but they shut that down. So this was the next best thing over in a CERN. Over here, this is WS2F.
I believe, but I'm not sure, that the state-of-the-art of cryogenic or superconducting magnets, when that one in Texas was being built, I think the decision was made that the superconducting magnets had not progressed far enough to guarantee operability. In the case of CERN's machine, I think a lot of study went into those magnets to be sure that they are a reality before they began construction. But here's the question I've got for you, Paul, which you might know. To my knowledge, most of the modern used superconducting materials become superconducting at liquid nitrogen temperatures and slightly above. So once you've got liquid nitrogen around your superconducting wires, they are superconducting, set up a magnetic field, and you're in like lead. Why in the world, if liquid nitrogen is giving you superconducting, are they going all the way down to liquid helium instead of 77 degrees Kelvin? They're going down to more like 4 or 5 degrees Kelvin. Why all the extra cooling if it's already superconducting? I've got a guess that every superconducting wire has a maximum current it can tolerate before it stops becoming superconducting, before it stops being superconducting. So my guess is that maximum current tolerance increases as you go to the lower temperatures. So maybe you can get greater magnetization once you use liquid helium. WS2N, K2RIW in the deck net.
Yeah, I know they're worried about the magnets warming up even a little bit. And they call it a quench problem. You've got trillions of these particles going around this ring being held in place by these magnets. Without them, they would just, go off into a tangent. So I think it's 11,000 times per second they go around this gigantic 17-mile ring. If you were to drive it at, 60 miles an hour, I think it would take you something like 15, 20 minutes or something to drive around the circumference. These things are going 11,000 times in 1 second. So these things are really hauling. And I believe the laws of physics also apply to the things that are in motion tend to gain mass from our perspective. So trying to keep these things in a circle is supposed to be very difficult. So the bigger the circle, of course, the better it is, and they make them go faster. And to keep these things in track, they rather have very low temperatures, because if they warm up just a little bit, they call it a quench problem. The magnets would all of a sudden very quickly, you would create a little resistance. That would accelerate the problem real quick when we drop it. And with that, you'd have a failure. And they say these particles would fly out of this atom smasher, literally blow a hole through the side of it. And I think they said it would go 300 feet into the ground. Now this thing is buried like, I forget how deep, but it's buried in, on the ground. for a number of reasons, and that's the, probably the number one reason that things ever got loose. It won't, you know, take off and kill anybody. It's on the ground. Also, the other reason is these things in motion let off radiation. They said if you're walking next to these pipes when the thing is in operation in the tunnel, anywhere in that tunnel, you won't last too long, you know, maybe a minute or so, you'll be radiated to death. So that's the other reason. Nobody's allowed in the tunnel when the thing is in operation, Dick. That's pretty much what I know about it. Back to you, Dick.
Interesting. And I can see how if a wire in a superconducting magnet starts getting a little bit warm, starts developing resistance, a voltage drop occurs across that resistance, which warms it up some more. So it's a runaway condition. I guess you call it that, the Quincy condition, or I guess it could be called a magnetic crash of that particular magnet. And by the coupling of that magnet to the adjacent magnet, it might even create some grease on the adjacent one and trigger another a domino effect. What is the prediction, Paul, as to when the machine comes up to full power and really starts looking for the exotic product? Is that a week, a month, or half a year away? Back to you, Paul. T2RIW.
Hang on now, Dick. So, it says it's like, there's no halfway. It's not like they throttle up, you know. So, this thing has come up online. And I assume all the four detectors are ready. You see pictures of it. It's enormous where these things crash into one another. They have a gigantic facility four different locations. They showed the one, we call it the Alice. I think it was the Alice. They call it. It's hard to describe, but when they hit, they run out, you know, from the center. Many hundreds of feet out, and they have all these different materials that these particles would travel, and somehow they manage to track these particles, and they can tell by looking at them what they are, if they're the new ones that they're looking for. You know, it's really an extension of the original ones that they used to have where they had clouds of gas, and when the original ones were smashing to one another, when they first started making atom smashes, they could actually see the path that they were taking. It's just an extension of that enormous room for each detector, and they'll be able to see where all these hundreds of subatomic particles are going, and if they're disappearing or not, or they're looking for it. Let me drop it. They're looking for supersymmetry. They want to prove out string theory and look for dark matter and all. When they start coming out with the information, I'm sure it'll be on the internet. You've got this is nothing hidden in this place. This is not like top secret. They're not making nuclear bombs here, and it's all shared information from many, many countries around the globe. I think probably the main news story of this thing was that, you know, people were worried about, you know, creating a black hole. That was the other thing. But we'll really go back to the beginning of time. That's really what they're trying to do, is go back to the original Big Bang. I think they've gotten it down to the first millionth of a second, and this is going to bring you down to the first three nanoparts of a second. I mean, it's really cutting it down, you know, many hundreds of, well, even thousands of times earlier than what they could already do, Dick. So, you'll see things coming out, I'm sure, on the internet first. If it's really newsworthy, you'll It'll make the newspapers and even the news. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the theory that the new machine is going to be making mini black holes and all of the Earth's material falls into it, reasonably far-fetched as I see it, because cosmic rays from space are bombarding Earth all the time with energies that far exceed what that machine can do. So the chances of the machine doing something the cosmic rays haven't already done for billions of years is pretty slim. You guys have heard me describe what a gamma ray burst is. No matter what energy level you think you've created in your laboratory, or Mother has created and you've seen it with your instrumentation, no matter what energy level you think is the max, build better instrumentation, make better measurements, and you'll find Mother Nature somewhere in the universe is doing a much bigger bang than you ever knew about. So it's very humbling to find out how much we don't know. So that one I don't worry about. Just realize that we didn't answer Steve's earlier question on the subject of DirecTV reception during rainstorm. What can you do to improve it? Common sense would lead you to believe the rainstorm is creating extra attenuation, and by putting up a bigger DirecTV dish, you'll correct for that. And I think the answer is almost no. You'll get an improvement. Is the improvement worth the investment? You'll never know until you don't try it. Until you try it. Putting up a second dish and running a system of spatial diversity, I'm reasonably sure is not going to do it. Because it is my belief that the majority of the time, let me drop. The majority of time when you get a dropout during a rainstorm, it's caused by the large droplets being non-spherical and creating depolarization or cross-polarization coupling, where the clockwise signal of the odd channel from the satellite and the counterclockwise signal from the even channel, and I may have that backwards, but they alternate into an odd meeting, they start coupling into each other. Because it is an overlapping frequency scheme that's being used on the satellite television, the direct broadcast satellite. So when the poor converter box sees all of those cross-coupled signals, eventually it's equivalent of an extremely low signal-to-noise ratio, and it can no longer figure out what's going on. The defense for that is to be receiving the satellite some number of miles away, where that particular view is no longer through that very dense rain cloud between the Earth station and the satellite in geosynchronous orbit. Very few of us have got the resources to do that. In theory, you could set up a satellite dish at your grandmother's house 10 miles away, and by some means simultaneously couple the signal from the grandmother's dish and your dish locally into the same converter and let it choose the one that's got the best signal-to-noise ratio. That would be a solution. You can see that very few of us have got the resources to do that. But can you get enough spatial diversity to look around that rain cloud on your property with two separate satellite dishes? I think the answer is no. Can you, with the one satellite dish, create the polarization coupling that the large non-spherical raindrops are creating? I think the answer is no. But if you put up a bigger dish, a 36-inch dish instead of an 18-inch dish, which is purchasable online, the people in the drop who want to watch European satellites in the United States, which means you're outside of that footprint for the European satellites, quite a significant number of TV. And if you use a big enough dish, you can still receive that signal and get the European programming, in theory. So the larger dish will help. I don't think it's going to help a whole lot. It's going to give you an increased signal level. And in the case of a branch of a tree sitting in front of the dish, it would definitely help. I first want you to cut the branch. But if you absolutely positively can't cut the branch, and the dish has to be located there, then making the dish bigger will allow you to gather more signal. And could, as long as the extra area of the dish is outside of the area of the hot branch and the radio noise it's creating, then yes, you're going to come out ahead. If the extra area of the bigger dish is going to be looking through more of the tree, it could be hurting more than it's helping. So you've got to keep track of gain to temperature ratio of all these phenomena on the ground station. And once again, correcting that large raindrop problem, which is what I think is the majority of the dropouts you see. I suspect there's no simple solution to that. I'm sure the adaptable converter that they're now putting into digital television converters, that kind of technology applied to the cross-coupled clockwise, counterclockwise satellite signals. Could there be a compensator put in there that corrects some of that? I think the answer is yes. I wonder if Eric knows of any studies along those lines that Eric happens to be listening. KE2EJ, K2LIW in the tech net.
K2RWK2J. Well, you got to consider the fact that it depends upon the modem that they use. Whereas when you think about the terrestrial ATSC, there's a little extra help called cellular encoding. We don't get that on the satellite. Satellite is either BPSK, QPSK, and in very rare instances, 16 QAM. And sometimes 32 QAM, but not as a major way to go. And DVB, which is the stream format, there you can get some help in there. But, you know, when it comes to rotating polarizations, you know, make the dish as big as you want. And I, believe me, I got big ones. And when there's enough water in the way, it becomes a problem. I don't care how big your dish is. So that's why many facilities have multiple uplink sites. You know, they're at least 250, 200 miles away from each other. So that way, if one has some bad clouds, chances are the other one doesn't. By the way, most of your DBS stuff is not circularly polarized, it's horizontally and vertically polarized. When you get to the KA stuff is circularly polarized. K2RW, KEPJ.
Wait a minute now. I'm reasonably sure that the DirecTV and what's the other service? I keep forgetting it. Dish Network at KU band, 11 to 12 gigahertz region. I'm reasonably sure, and I've done some experiments on this, 5 years ago. Yeah, 5 years ago I was doing experiments on it. I'm pretty sure the odd channels are clockwise and even channels are counterclockwise or vice versa. Real circular polarization is taking place in the DirecTV downlink KU band channel. I'm not sure, but I think you said something different than that, Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, I did say something different. You're going to make me crazy. Let me get to my favorite satellite site and confirm what I just said, just so that I'm giving out accurate information. Give me a second.
We'll stand by.
This is TSS, I've got a question about how to improve my signal quality.
Okay, somebody with a fairly noisy signal asked how he can improve signal quality. Give me your call letters and name, sir.
The call is KC2PSS, Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Foxtrot 7, and the name is Danny.
Okay. Danny, I think you said Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Foxtrot Sierra. That's what I think you said. And go ahead with your question, Danny.
Is the call is correct? I'm operating on 5 watts. Connected to a magnetic antenna, and I have a limited budget. I want to know if you have any ideas how I can improve signal quality. Go ahead.
Oh boy, there's lots of them there, Danny. Altitude will always improve signal levels on VHF, UHF frequencies. So, that mag-mount antenna, if you can do anything to increase its altitude, you're going to get a lot more signal. You clear the terrain, the trees, the buildings, whatever, and more signal gets to where you want it to go. That's number one. That's the highest bang for the dollar. There's many a guy who's got some kind of a simple antenna, like a mag mount, stuck to the refrigerator or stuck to a radiator in the house, and he's getting reception. But the repeater's not hearing him very well. He can build a simple $3 coat hanger antenna, something that's really yucky looking, flaky, but mounted on the chimney of the house. There's a good possibility, and a medium quality transmission line from the chimney down into the house. That insulation can make the signal 20 decibels stronger at the repeater site. That's a 100-to-1 ratio in power. In other words, you were running 1 watt before, and you run the same 1 watt into this coat hanger antenna on the chimney, and now the repeater will think you're running 100 watts, even though you're still running 1 watt. I can give you a big bang for the dollar. The next step beyond that is to build antennas with directivity, an antenna that's got real gain in some direction, like a vertically polarized Yagi. The Yagi can be made out of a piece of fairing strip used as the boom, and the elements, again, made out of coat hanger wire. Choose the right design, and I think WB5BJB has got some articles that he's published in the last couple of years on that exact subject. And either CQ Ham Radio or, I think it was CQ Ham Radio from the last year. He had an article on a coat hanger Yagi antenna. You know, $2 worth of materials that'll again increase your signal by 10 decibels. A 10-to-1 improvement in power apparent. And now you combine the two. You put that coat hanger Yagi antenna with some varnish on the wood or substitute PVC pipe so it doesn't fade in the weather, and mount it on the chimney, and now you're 30 decibels stronger. The repeater will think you're running 1,000 watts instead of 1 watt. These are all doable. It'll take some elbow grease and a little bit of study, but it doesn't take big bucks. Back to you, Danny. KC2, Tango, Foxtrot Sierra, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. Can you just repeat how you said decibels amount to make the copy down? That's all the idea, and we'll be able to implement some of them. To be able to get my dad's help, or my dad, KC2DAS is also a licensed ham. I'm relatively new to the hobby, got my license in April, which is a technician, and I'm also relatively young, 14 years old. I'm enjoying the hobby, and any little thing that can help me is good. So, if you could just repeat the, what you said, make it 30 decibels louder, that would be very much appreciated. Thank you very much. KC2RW, KC2DSS in the text.
Okay, Danny. Most engineers rate signal levels with the decibel scale. You could do it in microvolts, but it's not very convenient. Most of us do everything in decibels. So, and the good news about decibels is that the numbers are much more convenient and easily to handle. The bad news is that another branch of exponential mathematics that you have to learn, and some people have a fair amount of trouble with it. But I'll give you a couple of checkpoints. Write yourself two vertical columns. The left column is going to be the decibel number. The right-hand column is going to be the ratio it equals. So, the first number that people usually write down in the left-hand column is 3 decibels, 3 dB. And that's abbreviated with 3, lowercase delta, uppercase bravo. 3 dB equals 2. or 2 to 1. If I've done something to double my power, I've made a 3 dB increase, plus 3 dB. If I've done something to half my power, I've made a minus 3 dB change. So 2 to 1 change, up is plus 3 dB, down is minus 3 dB. That's your first row. The next row, most people would put the number 6. 6 decibels equals 4 to 1 power ratio. So 6 in the left-hand column equals 4 in the right-hand column. But most people will now put the next number, 10. 10 in the left-hand column, 10 dB, equals 10 to 1 power ratio. That's the one place where they come together. So 10 decibels equals 10 to 1. If I made a 10 decibel increase in my transmitter, then what used to look like 1 watt now looks like 10 watts. The next number people will write down frequently is 20 decibels. And the left-hand number is 20. The right-hand number is 100. A 20 dB increase is a 100 to 1 improvement. The next row is going to be 30. 30 decibels is 1,000 to 1. So 30 decibels equals a ratio of 1,000. If I go from a milliwatt to a watt, I've made a 1,000 to 1 increase. I've made a 30 decibel increase. I'll go one more. 40 decibels is 10,000. 40 decibels.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
40 decibel change, plus if it's an increase, minus if it's a decrease, is a 10,000 to 1 change. You'll notice something when it comes to the decibels that end in 10. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. Take the very first digit of a decibel number ending in 0. Take the very first digit, and it equals the number of zeros in the ratio. 10 dB is 1 with 1 zero after it. 10 to 1 ratio. 20 dB, the number 2, means that there's 2 zeros after the 1, which gives you 100. 30 dB, there's a 3 as the first digit. It equals 1 with 3 zeros after it, 30 to 1. 40 dB, 4 is the first number, 1 with 4 zeros after it, 10,000. So you can see a little bit of a hint of how decibels represent exponential mathematics based on logarithms. So when you study logarithms a little bit more thoroughly, sometimes than the way they give it to in high school, some of us will make more improvement. And once again, raising that antenna from inside the house to the chimney of the house, just that extra altitude, with a reasonable quality feed line going to it, and you connect your radio to it in the house through the feed line to the coat hanger antenna on the chimney, it is likely to make a 20 decibel improvement, 100 to 1 ratio improvement. Make a Yagi antenna out of a coat hanger wire, a 5-element Yagi antenna, and articles by Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor Juliet Bravo, better known as Kent Britton, who writes the antenna articles every other month in CQ Ham Radio, among other places. He, from time to time, had simple coat hanger antennas. He's not the only source, but he's one of them. To get 10 decibels of gain out of a Yagi antenna is reasonably easy to do with a couple of dollars worth of material. Coat hangers and a piece of wood or a piece of PVC as the boom. So 10 decibels of gain, 10 to 1 ratio, Yagi antenna can do that for you. Combine the two, 10 dB of gain because it's a Yagi, 20 dB of gain because it's a up at the chimney level in altitude. Nice thing about decibels, whatever the ratio of improvement is from one effect and another effect, you multiply the effects to get the new ratio, but you add decibels. So 10 dB of improvement because of Yagi, 20 dB of improvement because of altitude, combine them, 10 plus 20 is 30, you get 30 decibels improvement. A Yagi at the chimney could be 30 dB louder.
Repeater,
A Yagi antenna mounted at the chimney could be 30 decibels louder than the rubber duck antenna used inside the house. And when you make your signal to a repeater 30 decibels louder, that's significant. You will speak with authority signal strength-wise. What used to be a flea power transmitter is now going to sound like something that's gangbusters to them. And you can do that for a very small number of bucks. KC2, Tango, Foxtrot, Sierra, KQRIW in the TechNet.
So I should think a 5-element cord hanging Yagi at chase level beginning of the quality feed mine out of a cord hanger, 5-element, and that'll give me a 30 dB gain. Good. I can do that for a relatively low amount of dollars, and even better. So, thank you very much. It's not an impassable. Should I just ask for the guy's call sign again? WA5-something, they didn't get the rest of it. Thank you very much. KC2, I've got your call sign. K2RW, KC2PFS and the TechNet.
Yeah, what I told you is reasonably real, Danny. One of the guys who has written articles telling you this kind of jazz is Kent Britton,